ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now, the ABC's podcast unpacking the latest political news when it happens. Every weekday, you'll hear me and the sharpest political minds at the ABC.
Me, Jacob Greber.
Me, Raph Epstein.
Me, Claudia Long.
Me, David Spears.
And me, Frank Kelly, for The Party Room every Thursday.
So join me for Politics Now, download and follow on the ABC Listen app.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. A warning before we start. This episode discusses the details of the Bondi shooting of 2025 and the Port Arthur massacre of 1996. We're not going to be graphic. We are talking specifically about the firearms used in both events. The first video footage I saw of the horrific attack on Australia's Jewish community in Bondi was of one of the gunmen being disarmed by a bystander. Oh! Ahmed Al-Ahmed, a Sydney tobacco shop owner, tackles the shooter from behind and wrestles his gun out of his hands. In an unbelievable scene, Ahmed then points the gun at the shooter, forcing him to retreat. He stands his ground as the second shooter advances on his position, firing as he goes. We've all had a lot of different emotions this week. Shock, horror, incredible sadness, anger. But one thought that I've been dwelling on since seeing that video is, what on earth is that gun doing in Bondi? It's a big gun, a 12-gauge shotgun, and it's firing rapidly. At one point, before Ahmed disarmed him, video shows the shooter firing two shots in 2 seconds. He's firing over and over and over before he's finally forced to reload. This happened in Australia. I thought, in fact, the world thought that a shotgun capable of firing so many rounds so quickly was banned here. Even former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull thought so.
I read a report that there was a pump-action shotgun involved. Now, I thought pump-action shotguns were not available. I was very much of the impression that they were not available.
And yet, according to New South Wales Police, apparently the gun that the shooter had was legal.
He had a Category AB licence, which entitled him to have the long arms that he had as registered firearms.
The government is now talking about tightening our gun laws to restrict firearms like this.
If you're not a farmer, if you're not involved in agriculture, why do you need these massive weapons that put the public in danger and make life dangerous and difficult for New South Wales police?
Australians are very proud of our gun laws, and we have good reason to be. They are world famous. The laws are frequently referenced in the wake of almost every tragic mass shooting in the United States. And yet, we've now seen two men terrorise Australia's Jewish community with legally owned, high-powered guns. There are, in fact, more guns in Australia now than there were before the famous gun laws were introduced. So what are the specifics of Australia's gun laws? Are they really as strict as we all like to believe? And if they are about to change, what could that accomplish? I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. Something that you don't see much anymore is a high-profile politician deliberately seeking out a hostile crowd to speak to.
News, what are you here for?
Meet Mr. Howard and see what he's got to say.
What do you think you'll be happy with what he's got to say?
I doubt very much.
On the 16th of June 1996, a cricket field in the small Victorian town of Sale was filling up with rather angry people.
We come to stick up for our rights. Why do you need to?
Why do we need to? Because if we don't make a stand now, we'll lose everything.
The headline speaker was set to be the Prime Minister, John Howard.
Can you just tell us why you're here?
Why? Mainly because people's rights are being taken away from them. They've done nothing wrong and they're being victimised.
The issue at hand was whether people should be forced to give up their high-powered firearms.
All I'd like to know is you keep saying that 95% of the public don't want guns. Where does he get his figures? Just answer me that. That's all I want to know.
Ahead of the event, the police became concerned that the Prime Minister was in danger.
The AFP tell me they've had a quite explicit warning. The local police have had a quite explicit warning that somebody's going to shoot you.
He was urged by police and one of his top advisers to wear a bulletproof vest.
I don't know if they're right or wrong, but I have no idea how I would go and tell Jeanette and your family that we were warned for you to wear this flak jacket. You didn't, and you got shot. I have just no idea how I would say that to your family.
When Howard arrived, wearing the bulky vest under his suit jacket, he was greeted by a local gun control activist.
Thanks, Mr. Howard, for to sale. On behalf of 10,000 Victorians, I present to you these petitions which strongly support your view on gun control.
But as he climbed the steps of the grandstand, the crowd let him know that they were not happy to see him. National leaders don't usually do this. They don't usually organise big events where they know they're going to face a furious crowd. A crowd so furious that police are advising you to wear a bulletproof vest. But John Howard was determined to do it anyway, because of the importance of the policy he was trying to implement.
If the political process in Australia turns against me because of the decision that I have taken, I will accept that decision.
His conviction to get this policy over the line was because of something that happened 7 weeks earlier.
A lone gunman, armed with a high-powered rifle, entered the Port Arthur historic site and began firing randomly.
I'd only been in the job of Prime Minister a few weeks, and I was at home at Kirribilli House that weekend. And I flicked on the television, and before long, I knew he had this unbelievable disaster.
The Port Arthur Massacre, the worst gun massacre in Australia's modern history, took place over the course of 20 hours. But most of the fatalities took place in less than 2 minutes.
It was all over in 90 seconds. He murdered 20 people and a number of other people were seriously injured.
The shooter was able to do this because he had an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, a lightweight gun that can fire a lot of bullets very rapidly. Despite not having a firearms licence or even a driver's licence, the shooter had been able to buy the gun from a local dealer. In 1996, you technically needed a licence to buy a firearm, but some gun shops just didn't bother asking for them. High-powered, rapid-fire rifles like this one were easy to get. There were hundreds of thousands of them across the country.
I was totally and utterly thunderstruck that there could be such an appalling loss of life at the hands of one man. It affected me.
In the days after the massacre, John Howard attended the memorial service for the victims in Tasmania and met Dr. Brian Walpole, an emergency specialist from Royal Hobart Hospital.
And there was a doctor who'd been treated a lot of the people with horrific injuries, and he started explaining what had happened and he broke down, and I embraced him. It seemed the most natural thing in the world to do.
Howard listened to several tragic stories about what had unfolded that day.
Walter Meckag, of course, had lost his two beautiful daughters and wife, and he wanted me to do something to stop it happening again.
He returned to Canberra determined to do just that.
I can remember discussing this issue with some of my staff, and one or two of them said to me, "You're not really thinking of banning all semi-automatics, are you?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "We might as well go for broke on this."
The barrier Howard faced wasn't the opposition Labor Party. He'd just won a landslide victory, and the new opposition leader immediately threw his full support behind gun control.
Those who would resist him have got to understand that 90% of the public believes in the propositions that he put forward.
The barrier was from inside his own Conservative coalition. Howard, a lifelong resident of suburban Sydney with no background in agriculture or hunting, was surrounded by rural colleagues who were opposed to his point of view.
You know, sitting around the cabinet table were people who actually owned a lot of guns.
Howard knew virtually nothing about guns, so he called his primary industries minister and asked him for advice.
He said, "Your job is to explain to me and convince me as to what sort of firearms farmers need and legitimately must have access to. What sort of gun do you use?" And I hesitated for a moment because I thought, I don't quite know how to tell the Prime Minister that I have what he would regard as an arsenal.
He was asking for fine detail, though. He wasn't interested in his colleagues' arguments against banning guns.
We realised that Howard wasn't going to change his mind. I mean, you could give your arguments against the gun control and you knew he would listen to you politely and he would be patient with you, but you knew you were talking to a brick wall. He was not going to change his mind.
Consultation inside the government was brief, to say the least.
I have not changed my views. I will not be changing my views.
Within 2 weeks of the Port Arthur massacre, Howard had consulted with police commissioners and state and territory governments and come up with a final plan.
I'm very happy to announce that the Commonwealth and the states and territories have agreed on a uniform and much tougher approach to gun laws, which will, in our view, make Australia a much safer place in which to live.
The decision was that identical laws would be introduced across all Australian states and territories. The laws would organise guns into categories and implement a licensing and registration system for their use. Handguns, pistols effectively, would be category H. Long guns, like rifles and shotguns, would be split into four categories, A, B, C, and D, with A being the least restricted and D being essentially banned, with very few exceptions.
I clearly have in mind the police and the armed services.
But already you can start to see how this gets complicated. The police and military need exceptions. So do some farmers and some professional shooters who are charged with controlling feral animals. And figuring out which guns go into the most restricted category is difficult.
The problem is that it's like drunk driving. You have to set a threshold, and that threshold has to be somewhere.
What you want to say is nobody can have the guns that kill large numbers of people very quickly. But how do you write that into a law? There's thousands of different models of guns with hundreds of different firing mechanisms and dozens of different types of ammunition. Where's the threshold between very, very dangerous and still dangerous but okay for people to have if they've got a license? What goes into category A and B, which are available to most people with a gun license, and what goes into category C and D, which are only available to people who
can satisfy the police that they have a genuine need for them which cannot be met by any other methods or any of the non-prohibited weapons.
The government eventually decided to make these guns essentially illegal.
All other self-loading centerfire rifles, all self-loading and pump-action shotguns, and all self-loading rimfire rifles.
This was effectively a restriction on all guns that can fire lots of bullets quickly. Self-loading, or semi-automatic guns, are guns that can fire like this quickly. The action of pulling the trigger is both firing a bullet and loading a new bullet into the chamber. Those are all highly restricted in category D. A pump-action shotgun is your classic chuk-chuk-boom type of shotgun. You need to pull a slide on the barrel to load each cartridge, but they can still be fired very quickly, like this. Those guns would be put in category C, which would be available to some farmers, but only if they have a magazine capacity of less than 5 rounds. If the gun was capable of firing more than 5 rounds without reloading, they would go into category D. If a gun met any of those criteria, self-loading or pump action, they were not available for gun enthusiasts, amateur hunters, or most farmers. They were very strictly controlled. People who already owned the newly banned guns would be able to hand them into the government in exchange for the market value of the gun. As for the firearms that remained legal under the new guidelines, they'd be registered on a centralised national database, and checks were to be carried out to make sure people were storing their guns safely. Another element that was introduced was that all gun owners would now be required to demonstrate that they had a legitimate need for a gun, either for work or because you're a member of a gun club. You couldn't just get a gun license because you like guns. And that was a big change.
Needless to say, this represents an enormous shift in the culture of this country towards the possession, the use and the ownership of guns. It is an historic agreement.
Public support for the agreement was enormous. Polls at the time indicated that around 90% of Australians were behind the Prime Minister's law changes. Of course, 90% isn't everyone.
You can send a message all the way down to Canberra
to that sawn-off little dickhead, Jackboot Johnny.
Around the country, there was serious anger among gun club members in particular.
The only currency that you can purchase freedom back with is blood.
And yet, despite the resentment, John Howard decided to tour these gun clubs to speak to people about the decisions he'd made.
Oh, get out, you clown!
He made it clear to the crowd at Sale Oval that this was not a consultation. It was an explanation.
Sir, I haven't come here to negotiate the government decision. I've come here to explain it. I've come here to try and justify it.
John Howard has never been a physically imposing man. His small stature and flinty voice were a constant subject of ridicule during his political career. The oversized jacket that day in Sale didn't help, nor did the obvious bulletproof vest underneath. Howard says he doesn't regret anything about his speech that day, except for wearing that vest.
I'm sorry I did. I really am. I felt a bit of a goose afterwards for having worn it.
But the image of this small man shouting a defence of his policy over the furious jeers and boos of the crowd, with a plane circling overhead pulling a sign saying, "Stick to your guns," was seared into the public memory.
There come occasions for any government to take decisions which can only be effectively implemented in the interest of the overall national good if they involve some disproportionate inconvenience and some disproportionate deprivation for one section of the community. I'm sorry about that, but there is no other way. There is no other way.
John Howard was willing to face people who had supported his election and stubbornly shrug off their anger because this policy was really important. He wouldn't go through this otherwise.
...will benefit the overall national good, and that is the reason behind this decision, ladies and gentlemen.
And the proof was in the pudding because the reform was an exceptional success. During the 12 months after the legislation was passed and the government's buyback scheme was implemented, Australians turned in about 650,000 guns. In the years since, Howard's policies have been heralded by gun control advocates all over the world. Since they were passed, Australia's gun homicide rate has gone down by more than half. Australia remained mostly safe from mass shootings of the kind we see in the United States, which is why the Australian community was so shocked by what happened on the first day of Hanukkah celebrations in December 2025. Two shooters, Naveed and Sajid Akram, a father and son, arrived at Bondi with a cache of guns and started shooting at the large Hanukkah celebration at the crowded beach. Video evidence shows the father, Sajid, firing a shotgun rapidly. I count at least 8 shots between reloads. Police say that he owned this gun legally with a Category AB license. But how is that possible? Rapid-fire shotguns capable of firing more than 5 rounds between reloads were put into Category D all the way back in 1996.
In Australia, if you're wanting to use a shotgun for hunting, it has been difficult to get a gun that has more than 2 shots.
Well, despite the fact that pump-action shotguns were in Category D and essentially banned, it turns out that some gun makers have been sliding through the cracks by changing the firing mechanism, the way that the shotgun loads each shell into the chamber.
It can fire 8 shots in as many seconds, using a firing mechanism straight from the Wild West.
In 2015, a company in Turkey started making shotguns that use a very outdated lever action mechanism, which is not as good as a pump action. But because of this change, it means it fits into Category A instead of the far more restrictive Category D.
This weapon is clearly not far off a pump action shotgun, and we severely restrict the use of those because the speed with which they can be used.
The ABC was given a demonstration of both a pump action shotgun and the lever action shotgun being fired by the same person. Watching them firing side by side, the lever action gun is about half the speed, 1 bullet every second instead of 2. But still, one bullet every second is a lot of bullets.
People are going to have no defence against it for 8 rounds. That is a rapid-fire weapon.
When these new guns started entering the country, proponents of gun control were extremely concerned.
If you're a mass shooter, which is what the Port Arthur laws were designed to curb, then that's the type of gun you go for. You go for something that's going to just fire and fire and fire and fire and fire.
Gun importers argued these new guns were very different, but not everyone was on board with that idea. Some users of online gun forums clearly see this as a way of getting around the 1996 gun laws. The lever action loophole was closed in 2017 when these shotguns, if they had a magazine capacity of more than 5, were restricted. But the reprieve didn't last long because soon after, new shotguns with different types of firing mechanisms were designed to take their place. This has meant that over the last decade, there has been a cat and mouse game between governments and gun importers as different types of high-powered shotguns are introduced into the market and then restricted. This is how the Bondi shooter was able to legally own a shotgun that can fire so many shells in rapid succession without reloading. Both of the shooters can be seen using guns with straight-pull mechanisms, which have only recently been introduced to Australia and are still available to Category A owners. High-powered weapons like this, creeping into the more accessible categories A and B, is just one of several examples of how gun laws have been neglected since 1996. A few gun owners have contacted us since the Bondi attack to tell us that they're shocked by how easy it is to get a gun license in Australia. They've also told us that they think that audits by regulators are too infrequent. People smuggling guns into the country has also become a serious issue. There are now an estimated 260,000 unregistered illicit firearms in circulation in Australia. Another issue is there's no cap on the number of guns you can own, which has led to growing instances of people stockpiling guns.
Last week, police searched 70 properties throughout the state. They seized 135 firearms and cancelled or suspended 44 gun licences.
Police-conducted weapons inspections have been met with heavily armed and very angry people.
Police came here at 7:30 this morning to conduct a firearms inspection. They say that when officers arrived, they were threatened.
A candlelit vigil was held in Toowoomba for the young constables shot dead at Weambilla last December.
Most Australians are proud of our gun laws, and most think that they keep us safe from the horrors of mass shootings that we see around the world. But clearly that's no longer the case. And now, in the wake of this attack on the Jewish community, Australia's biggest mass shooting since Port Arthur, the government is looking to update laws that have been left fairly dormant for 3 decades.
National Cabinet agreeing to consider limiting the number of firearms a person can own, curbing open-ended gun licences and restricting gun ownership to Australian citizens.
In the days after the shooting, New South Wales Premier Chris Minns announced that his government would be specifically addressing the loopholes in the law that allowed these guns to be legally bought.
We are proposing a bill to reclassify straight pull-up and pump-action shotguns, to look at reducing magazine capacity for shotguns.
The laws are likely to pass quickly, as there is still strong popular support for gun control measures. But John Howard, author of the original gun laws, says tightening those laws isn't the only thing that needs to be addressed.
Focus on guns, it's welcome, always. Provided it's designed to tighten existing laws, to eliminate loopholes, but I do not want the focus on guns to be used as a pretext to avoid the broader debate about the spread of hatred of Jewish people and anti-Semitism.
And of course he's right. There's no doubt that further tightening gun laws will make Australians feel safer in their communities. But figuring out how to stop gun importers finding legal loopholes is going to be complex. What's even more complex is figuring out what to do about the fact that there are people in our society who are willing to attack a religious celebration on a sunny summer afternoon in a beachside playground.